Why are they shaking their heads? We're stuck in slow life. Is it the beating of the chest that makes us feel the rest? Good day, everyone. This is March Twisdale. Let me start by asking a question. Have you ever wondered what great ideas might be hiding just next door in another culture or country? Well, if so, then this show is for you. It's really interesting the types of things that people will say and what they think when they've lived in a different culture than us here in the United States of America. Today, I'm talking with Peter Madsen. Hey, Peter, how are you? Thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you for having me.
So what time of day is it there for you right now?
It's evening. It's about 7 o'clock p.m. and it's dark outside because this time of year it's dark at this hour.
When I visited Denmark 2 years ago, I remember being amazed at about midnight to 1 a.m. was when the sun in the summer, June, finally started to really disappear, like the redness went away. And then I haven't been there in the winter, but what, you guys must get dark like around 3 o'clock in December?
Not that early. Then you'd have to go to Norway or Sweden. But around 4, half past 4, it's getting dark. So, yeah. Well, we benefit from it in the summer, but then in the wintertime, it gets darker.
And you pay for it.
That's it.
Okay, so Focus On is recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon, broadcast at 11 a.m. on Sundays and 5 p.m. on Fridays here in the Seattle area on 101.9 FM KVSH. You can also stream it online and check it out on my website as a podcast. That's at marchtwisdale.com. If you end up having to leave partway through the interview, just come back and catch it later online. To get us started, Peter, if you can give our listeners a sense of who you are and what you do, that would be great.
Well, I make my living telling stories, and I've done that all my life, actually. I found out that I liked drawing when I was a kid, so I continued and I never stopped. But then I found out that I could put one drawing after another and tell a story with them. So that led to comic strips. And that's what I've mostly been doing. Then I've done picture books. I like writing also. I've worked in animation. But comic strips or graphic novels is the main thing for me.
It sounds like a very pleasant way of living your life, basically hanging out and creating what you dream up, you create on paper.
Yeah, and what I like about it is also that it's very low tech. It's not, you don't have to have a big crew. You don't have to have a lot of funding. You can just, if you have a paper and a pencil, you can create your story. And having worked with stage plays and like we produced a movie also based on my comic strip, I mean, I really like being able to do things without having to ask people for their money.
So I'm looking here. I have two of your books. Thank you. They arrived in brilliant condition. And I mean, traveling all the way across the Atlantic, it doesn't always happen that way. And I'm looking at Tales from the Troll Forest. And I'm curious because I'm not an artist at all. I don't have that natural inclination. My older son does, but I don't. And so a lot of times when I look at art, I can't even begin to guess or imagine how it was created. Was it chalk or was it pencil or whatever? So I'm looking at the front cover of Tales from the Troll Forest, and there's obviously colors in here, but there's also fine detail. What medium do you use for creating your images?
Yeah, actually, I have to admit that for the troll books, I have taken the leap and used the computer for coloring. Most of what I do is done in the very old-fashioned way. But I found out that for the trolls, I wanted this line of the pencil or the chalk. And the problem is if you create a pencil drawing and then color with watercolors or whatever on top of it, you'll get this wishy-washy thing where the pencil is very gray and the color covers it. But if you take your pencil drawing and you scan it in the computer, you can enhance the color of the pencil. You can make it sepia-toned, and you can make a bigger, what do you call it, a harder contrast. And then if you do the coloring on a layer in the computer under the drawing, then you will still preserve this rustic quality of the drawing, which I like. So actually, I've done the coloring on computer to preserve this feeling of the line. That was a long sentence.
No, that's so cool. Because now, of course, the people who are sitting in their cars or hanging out at home, they're having to keep up with you in their minds. But I'm sitting here looking at these images, and yes, I can totally see what you're talking about. How really you've got all those fine, delicate pencil lines. But no, they're not blurred out. I mean, I could imagine what you were saying about how the watercolors would change it. And of course, it doesn't happen here. So you also must have evolved your art over time and not just like at the age of 23, you said, I like how I do art. I will never change. So this was one example of that evolution moving to the computer, it sounds like.
Yeah, actually, my main interest is telling stories. I tell the stories with a combination of drawings and words. So I think the most important thing for me is always the story. So every time I do a picture book or a comic or whatever, I should go for what is the best medium, what is the best drawing style to tell this story. So sometimes it will be a watercolor drawing. Sometimes it will be acrylics. I change my style every time to get the story told the way I want to tell it.
Everyone who lives in the Seattle area and has not been out to visit Vashon Island yet, feel free to come on down and you can swing by the bookstore on Vashon. There's only one in little downtown Vashon, and these books will be out there and you can come take a look at them if you want, because they are really fun. What I'm noticing here in the front cover, where you go through and you have all your individual characters sort of and their names, a woman from Iceland who writes children's stories also made the point that she wants her storybooks to almost be something that could be told by picture alone. And the words are there, and that's great, but that little kids, she was talking about how they are pre-language, and they tend to learn a great deal or understand a great deal from expression and the movements of people's bodies rather than just the words. So your facial expressions of all these characters tells us so much sort of about what they're thinking or the frame of mind that they're in. I would imagine, even though there are words in the book and it's not for little teeny kids, that if you had a young child reading this book with you, they would get a lot out of it because of the images.
That's right. I mean, the troll books, I do these books together with my wife, and we are always focusing on the child and the parent or grandparent. These books are meant to be read together. And we have kids ourselves, so we know how it is when you have this book that a kid loves with a little red ball that hops and you are so tired of it because it's
so, I'm sorry, just thinking of like the evil sister-in-law, especially if they don't have kids. And at Christmas, they send a package in the mail and it's some hideous plastic toy that goes meep, meep, boom, boom, meep, meep, boom, boom, endlessly. And pretty soon mom and dad have taken the batteries out, you know, because like you're going crazy. Okay. Oh my God. Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
We always want to have something in the books that are for the parent and some that are for the kid and some are for both. And you're right about these facial expressions and the drawings. The thing is that the words in the books are not easy for a little kid to read. And there'll be some words that taste good or that we want in there, but are not easy words always. Mm-hmm. But then the kid can sit and look at the drawings while being told the story. And afterwards, the kid will be able to go through the story for himself or for herself, because the drawings will be there. We try to do this in tandem, and sometimes maybe even the drawing can contradict what the text says. That's also an interesting thing, or complement each other.
Mm-hmm. I grew up, I feel so grateful that I was born in 1972 and that I grew up really before all of this crazy cable, computer, television stuff just took life over. So we didn't have a TV at all when I was a kid, and books and magazines and music, records, that was the go-to, you know, in my home childhood environment. Being read stories at night before I went to bed was just the most important part of my day, practically. And because I was initially pre-language, of course, those images, like, I still now have these really strong sort of story feelings when I remember the images, because I don't have the language, I don't remember the sentences, but I remember the feelings of the story, and they're linked to the images. And it's really funny. I think a lot of times post-language adults forget, especially with all the pressure that's put upon us to make sure our kids learn how to read. There's so much interesting fear out there in the world that's placed upon parents. You know, are you going to do a good job, and will your kids get what they need? So I think a lot of times parents sit down to read with this ulterior motive of, I want my kid to like reading, and I want them to learn how to read, more forgetting just how much of a pure joy it is and a pleasure for the child to hear the story.
Yeah, I think for us, it's of course we have we don't have messages like that, but of course we want to tell something important in our stories, but we want it to be a shared pleasure for the family. And when I make the drawings, facial expressions are very important. I make a lot of work studying also the human body. When I go and draw poses or model drawings, I draw pretty realistically, almost like a photograph, because you need to know what you make a caricature of. But a lot of times, my wife, she writes the story first, and then we work on it together, enhance it, rewrite. And a lot of times, a lot of the things in the text are cut out, but they survive in the drawings. A lot of times there'll be a story, main story, and there'll be a lot of small extra things going on, and we need to sort of compress the text and get to the point and kill your darlings and all that. But a lot of the darlings can be in the drawings, and they can sort of enhance what's going on in the text. So it's a big mixture, and in the end, the story is not what is written with words. The story is the combination of the drawings and the words, of course.
Okay, correct. Cecil Boo and Peter Madsen.
Yeah, that was spot on.
Okay, perfect. So that other woman who I was speaking with, who does children's books in Iceland, and she was making the point that oftentimes, and I know this is true in the U.S. as well, which surprised me years ago when I was researching children's books, and I discovered how often the person who writes the story has no inkling of the imagery that would go with it, because they know that oftentimes within American publishing, you write the story, you hand it off, and the publishers are going to go to their preferred team of artists and illustrators, and those people will basically do what they want. Sometimes, she said, they'll take input from the author, but very often they won't, or if they do take it, they're not required to oblige by those ideas. Whereas you and your wife are really more intentionally collaborative. How long does it take, perhaps, for, so like this book, Tales from the Troll Forest, to give my listeners a sense, is Oh, goodness. Do you have page numbers? Ha, there's no page numbers. That's cute. How many pages is this?
Usually they're around like the 40 pages or.
Okay. There's no page numbers. Actually, I think the English translation is closer to maybe 25 pages here. It's not very long. But how long does it take you and your wife together to sort of get from the beginning to the end of a project like this?
Oh, it's hard to say because it's fermenting for a long time. When we are talking plot and the main ideas, it can take quite a lot of time. But once we get started, once we know where we're going, it's probably like half a year maybe, when everything is sort of in place. But can I tell you a little about how the whole collaboration started? Do we have time
Oh,
for
yeah, we had totally have time. You tell that story, and then I'm going to go to a quick station identification, and then we'll come back.
that? Okay, I have worked for 30 years on a comic strip called Valhalla about the Norse gods, the Viking gods. We wanted to retell the most important myths, so we didn't want it to turn into a fantasy series where we were inventing a lot of stuff. That project came to an end, and I was looking for what am I going to work with now? And my wife, she said, do something with trolls because you're very good at drawing trolls. And then I said to her, well, I can't just sit and draw trolls. I need to have some stories. So if you are so interested in me doing trolls, I mean, you should write some stories for me. And then I thought, then I had shut her up, and then we finished with all that nonsense. But then she actually started studying the subject, and she read a lot of books, and of course they are in the fairy tales and all that, but she read the books about what did people believe in the old days. People who in the 17th century had written down what old folks had told about the pixies or the gnomes or whatever. And then, after a couple of years of studying, she started writing stories. And she came with this project, an idea, let's do a troll family with mother and father and 11 kids. And then we started to working together on it. I have been doing comics for a long time, but my wife is not especially interested in comics. So she said, if I'm going to work on this, it has to be a books, picture books. And also, she said to me, I have never been a writer. She said, she had never been a writer. And if we were writing together, I would just take everything over and she would have no part in it at all. So she wanted to be the one who created the story every time. And then I could come in later on and come with my ideas and we could talk about how we could change it. But it worked out wonderfully because for me to have that input coming from her, it's crucial that it takes a little time before I can lay my hand on the things. And so it's a network, but I have never worked on a story where people would just present with a story, and I didn't talk to the writer, and I just did my drawings separately. I need to be part of the project. I need to mix in. I need to write new lines, and I need somebody to say to me, "Oh, I have thought about the drawing should be like this and that." So she mixes with and messes with my drawings also, and it's not always appreciated, but it's always good. So it's a total collaboration.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. Okay. I'm looking right now, folks. If you go to Google and you type in Valhalla, which is VALHALLA, and then you also type in, what did I do here on my Google search? Just make sure people get where they need to be. Is I put in Valhalla Comic Denmark, and poof, like all of these images come up. Do you have any of these translated into English?
No, and that's a bit strange because actually Valhalla has been translated into, I don't know if it's 11 or 12 languages, but English is not one of them.
Basically, mostly what Scandinavian languages, where people have like a traditional connection to these gods. or?
I mean, in Denmark, we've sold about 1 million books, and no, half a million books, sorry. Half a
That's all
million.
right. That's a lot, anyways.
A 250,000 in Sweden and 250,000 in Norway. But it's
Right.
also translated into Spanish and French and Dutch and Indonesian and a lot of other
Oh my
languages.
gosh, but not English. That is hilarious. I mean, you're missing a market, man. Okay, so here I'm gonna ask if you could send me a couple of copies, like, of your favorite comics or maybe number one and two, whatever. Can you send them in Spanish? Because we actually have a pretty large Central and South American community here on the island, and I speak Spanish. My husband was born in Mexico, so if you could send a couple, then I can put them out at the bookstore and people can come by and peruse them.
I'll see what I can find.
All right. I mean, it would be really cool if I could sort of connect with our local Spanish-speaking community and say, hey, I've got some books in there you can come check out. But okay, so I have done some collaborative writing myself, and that's why I was laughing when you said that it's not always appreciated. I co-wrote with a close friend of mine, and we were proud, very, very proud of the fact that after 18 months of co-writing together and producing a 1,000-word essay every month, we were still friends and we were both still alive. So we were very proud of that, and it's so true. The way we operate is a little bit similar to you and your wife, in that one of us would come up with an idea that they'd already sort of looked into. They had some ideas, they'd researched it, because this was really intense scientific research background concepts we were dealing with, and we would propose it to the other person in sort of already a gifted way, like, here's my idea, here's what I'm thinking, here's where I'm wanting to go. And that way, the other person, about half the time, you were the one presenting the first idea, and half the time, you were receiving the first idea, and you could give it that fresh read and then respond. And it was really beautiful, sort of sharing the roles of original ownership of the idea and responder and supporter of the idea. And it worked great.
Yeah, it's a delicate balance because in the beginning, Sissel really needs to be on her own and not have me interfering, and because everything is so fragile, and sometimes when I start talking and maybe give critique too early, it can ruin something. Of course, later on I need to do it, and also it's the same the other way around when I create something.
So, I'm going to take a quick break, Peter, to do a station identification. For all those folks out there who might have just joined us in the past few minutes, this is March Twisdale, producer and host of Focus On. Today, I'm interviewing how do I put this, 50% of the writing illustrating team of Peter Madsen and his wife, Sissel Boo. Before we return to the interview, I'd like to give a shout out to those folks who keep Voice of Vashon on the air. KVSH program support comes from Puget Sound Cooperative Credit Union, PSCCU. We're serving the financial needs of our neighbors in a not-for-profit manner, improving housing stock, lowering energy usage, and putting a lot of contractors to work is how PSCCU practices community and cooperation, Vashon style. Support for this program also comes from Island Escrow, Vashon's only independent escrow company providing comprehensive service for all types of real estate transactions since 1979. You can reach them at 206-463-3137. And now we're going to get back to the show. So I wanted to ask, what made your wife think about trolls?
Well, it's part of our culture, and as you say, it's the nature also. In Norway, normally trolls are considered very big and mean, and some of them have three heads, and they're people think about stone when they see trolls. Whereas in Sweden, they have big forests, so it's more connected with trees. And here in Denmark, we have a very friendly landscape with not the big we have hills and not mountains and so on.
That is true. You do not have mountains. 3,000-foot hill that people call a mountain, and I start laughing.
It's really funny. But our trolls are sort of a mixture of the three cultures. But actually, the trolls are also everything that is hidden. I mean, Freud would probably call it the subconscious or something. In the old myths or the old tales, when a man would suddenly leave his wife and just go away, I mean, they had stories about the trolls have taken him. He went into the mountain, and when you had a kid who was acting strange, there were stories about that this is a troll who has come and put his or her offspring in the cradle. All these
right.
stories about explanations of all the crazy things going on deep in our souls, that's been attributed to the trolls. And that is interesting. Of course, we are doing children's books, so there's a limit to how much violent or sexual content we have in the stories. But
okay,
still...
okay. So that's actually a perfect segue, because let's talk about limits. I agree. There's not a lot of sex in the book. That makes sense. But
no.
You touch upon a very interesting topic in this book in particular. How many troll books do you have?
We have made 10 of the big picture books. We've made six in a smaller format for smaller kids with more simple storylines.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Christmas books book with where you read what do you call it, a chapter every day
mm-hmm.
in the Christmas month. And then it's all like almost like a TV series where it all together becomes a big story. It's a much bigger book than the other ones.
Okay.
A lot of different books in different formats.
All right, so you've got a lot of them, and you happen to send Tales from the Troll Forest Best Friends to me. Okay, so I was really surprised. I was surprised that you got into the topics that you covered in this book, and I want to discuss that a little bit. I want to say I was surprised, but that doesn't mean I was displeased. If anything, in general, I tend to feel like we need to talk more openly with our young people about the real world rather than sheltering them. So I was happily surprised, let's put it that way. But so in this book, there is a serious focus on mushrooms. And I'm turning to the page, and all sorts of other things. There's this lovely mother, Ina, I guess, and she is the one who sort of creates magic ointments and herb brews. And as we all know as adults, a lot of those plants out there that are used as a medicine are oftentimes poisonous if they're used in a different way or if they're overused. Deadly nightshade, arnica, goldenrod, yarrow, not all of these, but... There's also, then, of course, they're wandering around the forest, and what do they find? There we go. They find Amanita mushrooms, which, if I remember correctly, are basically magic mushrooms. They're the ones that people use for psychedelic purposes, and, of course, they're poisonous. So then... Later, one of the things that you do is you do illustrate sort of the faulty mistake of a young person who's a little bit emotionally upset, who decides to break the rules and eat the Amanita mushroom and what happens. But before that, you said, where did I just say it? Somewhere you say in here that they are, there we go, that they are good for Father Rissel, like the older ancient adult troll is able to eat these mushrooms. And then she points to the chanterelles and she suggests that the kids eat the chanterelles, which of course are edible. So what was the point of bringing up all the mushrooms? What's the main message? Because you're not coming across as anti-Amanita mushrooms. You're actually alluding to them as being useful for the elders. But then, of course, they are poisonous and dangerous. So what was going on there?
Well, actually, this story is mostly a story about jealousy. It's a story about the little troll kid, Pyko. I don't remember the English names. Is he called Pyko?
Let me check. Where is it? Yeah, it's spelled Pajko, which we would think is Pajko or something, but
yeah,
you're saying
okay.
It's Pyko?
Yeah, in Danish we pronounce it like that. But anyway, his twin sister Paya is his closest friend, and then he becomes uncertain if she is really his closest or if he is her closest friend. And this jealousy eats him up. And then, as a little kid, he wants to impress her, and then he eats this mushroom, which is a very, very bad thing. I don't the ammonite. This mushroom is a very bad choice if you want to have psychedelic experience, because it's mostly poisonous. And there are tales about the Vikings going berserk when they ate these. I don't know. Mostly you just have a headache, and it's not the worst of that kind of mushrooms, because you vomit very easily, because it's really bad for you. And most people here in Denmark know that mushrooms because it has this bright red color, and it's very beautiful to look at. But we were thinking about maybe we should just talk about it just being poisonous and terrible and everything. But then again, these people are trolls, and Father Troll, he does many strange things. And we didn't want our characters to be totally correct and everything. So we created this thing that he eats these for some purpose, but the children should definitely not eat them. So this is not from the mushrooms for us are just a vehicle for telling this story about jealousy. Because then the sister is the one who saves her brother by running for the antidote. But we want everything in the books to sort of correspond with nature, and we wanted to show these mushrooms that you can find in nature, and we wanted to tell that they're poisonous, and we wanted to show that he gets sick and he is about to die from it. So absolutely, we don't want any children to just try it because it's fun or anything like that. That's very important for me to say. So I think in the story, it's pretty much shown that this is not a thing you should do.
Oh, yeah. In my culture, and I don't know if it's true in your culture, but in my culture, when things are dangerous, there is a tendency to under-inform children or youth and to rely upon an uninformed fear, to really try and use fear to make children be safe by avoiding something because they're scared of it, rather than sitting down and honoring the intellect of the young and explain to them, this is a beautiful mushroom. It's so pretty. It's this, it's that. However, did you know that if you do this, it's going to kill you, and you can say that in a way if you're not trying to instill fear. I think a lot of times the children, the youth, take you more seriously because when I think young people can tell when adults are telling scary stories because they just want you to do or not do something, and in a way, it makes the adult less trustworthy.
Coming back to nature, instead of just creating some strange mystical troll potion, actually, what she's looking for is another plant which is even more poisonous than mushroom. It's called Galnebær in Danish, and we call it by one of the common names, which is sort of troll cherries. But actually, it contains this.
I actually recognize what it is, and I'm looking it up here for you in the English book just to make sure that I get the name correct, as in what you're looking for. Let's see here. Let me find this. We actually have these plants where we live, and we have to be really careful of them as well. My these berries you're talking about, let's see, let me find it in here.
What the
Okay,
most,
you call it belladonna.
I'm not sure about the translation. I know the Danish names, but anyway, the mushroom contains muscarine. That's it's a nerve poison, but actually the belladonna is atropine, which is another nerve poison, neurotransmitter, and actually these two work as antidotes or can work as antidotes. And actually, she goes down to the church, and this is where the old monastery was, to find this plant because that grew in the monasteries because the monks used them in the medicine. And belladonna is, I mean, it's called the beautiful lady because they used to drop it in the eyes, and then it would make the pupil swell or grow, so you got these beautiful big black eyes. But actually, the person couldn't see a thing if you did
That's
that.
fascinating.
But the reason we dare use these things here in Denmark, at least, is that every child knows that these mushrooms, you shouldn't eat them. I mean, it's sort of a typical thing. You show that to children and say, don't eat that. The white mushroom or the green mushroom of the same kind are very dangerous and deadly, much worse than the red one. But everyone knows the red one. And the belladonna plant, the plant that Paya picks up in the end, is very, very, very rare here. So no child would ever find that in the wood. So it's because I would be very nervous if a child could just go out and find that plant and say, okay, now we'll eat a mushroom and then we eat that after.
Oh
Because that's a bad one to eat.
Well, the Brothers Grimm just, and what's the name of the gentleman in the town on the other side of the water who's really well known for writing children's stories?
The Brothers Grimm, or who are you
No, no,
talking
no.
about?
In Denmark, if you go, if you leave Copenhagen Island, you travel west.
No, Hans Christian
There
Andersen,
you
maybe.
go. I mean, he had it easier. He could write about anything, and he didn't worry about what kids might do. Those are some scary stories.
We want them to be trolls, and actually also the parents. I mean, we're not politically correct. Father Riesel, he also smokes a pipe. I don't smoke, and I'm not. I think it's a bad thing to do. It's a bad thing for children and for adults. But he smokes the pipe, and he's a good father sometimes. But he's also a terrible father. I mean, he in one of the books it deals with stealing or private property, and he tells the children that they are not to touch his things. But he goes down to the village and steals things from.
Oh no.
And he has his own rules. I mean, that some apply for him and some apply for the children. And the idea of that story is maybe you shouldn't own so much because he's very much attached to his big treasure and he always counts his money and all that. And the kids, maybe they shouldn't steal from him. Maybe it's much better not to be so hung up on owning things. So these kind of stories, we want to create some characters who are, I mean, he would be boring if he was just the perfect father and everything he said was the truth and so on.
I mean,
It is.
look at the Lord of the Rings, right? Gandalf and Bilbo, they smoked pipes, and of course you have, Frodo and them, they love to go get their pint of beer, and there's a richness in the world to human diversity. And that and the where we are in all these different places, and anything that becomes, well, if you're writing a story, everyone will say that the perfect character who never does anything wrong is incredibly boring to read about.
But our main interest with these stories, our main purpose is to tell, like we say, the small stories about the big things in life. And it is about jealousy, or it's about stealing, or it's about not daring to go to sleep because, I mean, that's one of the stories who's about the kids who are afraid to sleep. And trolls, they are not afraid of the dark. They're afraid of the sun, so they're afraid of the light. And then the children can sort of mirror his or her own fears in the world of the trolls. And maybe because they are afraid of the light, it's a little easier to handle. With a lot of these stories, we want to cope with these difficult and important themes for children, but we want to do it in a troll world. We want to do it in a world that is different from ours, and where the people behave strangely. So, well, it's a delicate. It's a fine line to walk because, I mean, we're not showing sex in the stories. We're not showing drunk people. I mean, Father Vrisel he's having a beer. We're showing that, but we're not showing him drunk.
Right.
I don't know.
I imagine it is an interesting fine line, given that you have, when you're producing something for children, you're going to have an influence in those kids, and also you want the adults in their lives to be comfortable with what that influence is. So yeah, I imagine it is, I mean, a fascinatingly fine line.
It is, but I agree with you. I mean, I can understand why you were sort of shocked when you read about eating mushrooms and stuff like that, but our purpose is absolutely not to say anything goes.
Right.
And if we show people who are way out of line or do strange things, I mean, I think we do it in a way where we don't say that this is a good thing to do.
But, yeah, you show the consequences.
Exactly.
Yeah. So real quick, I'm going to remind folks who they're listening to, and then we're going to go sideways into a completely different direction. Hey, folks, if you just joined us, my name is March Twisdale. I am the producer and host of Focus On, and today I'm talking with Peter Madsen, who is from Denmark. He's a really fun illustrator-writer. He works with his wife, Sissel Boo, and they are creating a whole bunch of really cool books, which you can go check out at the Vashon Bookshop if you'd like. And why are we on the air? Because we are supported. For example, Northwest School of Animal Massage, NWSAM, has something for every animal lover. Workshops, professional courses, and blended learning options that allow flexibility as students learn large and small animal massage for professional certification or to take special care of beloved pets. More information is available at nwsam.com. Voice of Vashon is also supported by Windermere Real Estate, making our emergency alert service possible. So now I want to go sideways a little bit. You said that initially you studied to be a doctor and you went to university in Denmark, and you were there for about 4 years working on a degree to be a physician. Yes?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Yes.
So in the United States, when someone goes to college and they spend 4 years working on a degree, or especially for us, medical school is more like 6 to 8 years, but when people do that, they almost always accrue debt, $30,000, $90,000, $150,000, depending on the school you're going to. They will basically walk out with a school debt that is about the same, maybe half the cost of buying a house. It's big. And so in the U.S., if you put all that money and time into getting a degree and you come out and you can get hired and you can work in that field and you can make good money because it's a professional field, if you just decide that maybe you don't like it and you want to go do something else, it's not a very easy decision to make because you're still carrying all that debt load. And so the energy or the idea in our country is, well, you better, you know, make that career work for you, even if you want to go do something else, because you've got to pay off all those loans. I'm curious, after going to school for 4 years in Denmark, did you have student debt?
No, I did not. And I guess this must sound very, very strange to you in the United States, because here in Denmark, to go to college, to medical school, for instance, is free. I mean, you have to pay your books, but it's totally free. You don't have to pay for it. And the medical school is 6 years now. It was 6.5 years when I studied, so I only went 2/3 of the way. But of course, I had to live also, and I made my living cartooning. And I was actually in the school for about 6 years because I had leaves now and then where I would just illustrate. And so I didn't take up any loans. I lived very. I had a very little. I had a room and not many expenses, so mm-hmm. so I could support myself. I could draw, make drawings and comics, etc. In the weekends, and I could sit at hospitals and work as a male nurse and whatever. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so I didn't have any debts.
So the last two times I've been in Denmark, I've had a chance to talk to a number of people who are students now, and your kids are 30 and 32, I guess, so they were going to school about a decade ago. I know that right now in Denmark, students in college receive about $1,500, that's American dollars, a month as a stipend to live on, which after taxes is around $900 a month that they actually get to take home and spend. I'm curious, when you were in school, was that also happening, or has Denmark actually added that since your time?
That was also happening at the time when I went to school, but I never applied for it. I made my own money cartooning, so it wasn't. I didn't think about it that it was a possibility, and I made my own money. So, I wanted to draw anyway. So
you had the opportunity to access that funding, and because you were doing okay on your own, it just sort of didn't occur to you to go for that. That is fascinating, because in the U.S., where schooling is not covered and kids are facing such huge expenses to go on and educate themselves at the university level, there's a real tendency to basically go for every possible source of funding you can get, especially if it's a grant that you don't have to pay back. No one would ever not go for that or not accept it. But I guess that makes sense, because they're carrying this huge, many thousands of dollars load of actually going, you know, actually paying for classes. Interestingly, back in the late 60s and early 70s, when my mother and father were going to college, at that point in California, there was state funding. They were going to UCSB at no cost to themselves, and they were even living in married student housing. And my dad, I remember telling me that he had access to grants, and the financial aid office wanted him to accept grants. And his reaction was, I don't need them. I don't want to take free money because I'm economically fine. So I find that interesting, that when school is covered and a person can make enough money on the side and they feel like they're doing okay, there's less of this desperate emotional need or desire for additional funding. Anyways, just sort of interesting there.
Yeah, I mean, my two kids made it all the way in medical school, so they're doctors, both of them. And I'm very happy that it was a possibility. I mean, a lot of people I know in the States, I mean, it's a big thing if you have to pay for a school, and it becomes, well, it's a difficult thing. I won't preach here, but I'm just mm-hmm. happy to have that opportunity, and maybe I pay more tax, but in the end, it costs a lot of money if you have to send your children to educate them. So
yeah, it's one of those things where a lot of, I think when you sit down, you look through the numbers. You know, one of the things that really struck me 2 years ago, when I was doing research into Denmark for about 2.5 years, and then 2 years ago I went and visited for the first time, doing some serious research for 17 days on the country and what it was like, and talking to people, just talking. And this one person who was from the US and had fallen in love with a Danish person and ended up moving to Denmark after living most of his adult life in the US in Southern California. I remember him saying to me at one point that the young people in Denmark, and he's in Copenhagen, that they don't really fully always appreciate or recognize how good they have it, because he can reflect on what it's like to be a young person in the United States, and then he looks at what's going on for them in Denmark, and he's very happy for the young people in Denmark, and he can see both sides. But when you grow up in just one culture or just the other, sometimes it's hard to see what you have, or maybe see what you don't have, because you can't see those other options, which is what Focus On is sort of about, giving people in America a chance to realize we're, I think, 5% of the population on the planet, and that there are so many people living so many different ways, and there are things we can learn from other people in other cultures. So your kids finished medical school and were basically debt-free when they stepped out the door and went out to become adults, to grow their career, to live their lives. They weren't carrying with them any school burden.
No, they won't. Some people do, but it depends. I mean, some people take up loans, and but it depends on my children worked a lot while they were studying also, so they didn't spend a lot of money. So, but the main thing is that the education itself is free, because that's a very big burden if you have to pay for that.
I know, imagine if your kids each had like $150,000 in debt and like a $1,400 a month payment.
Yeah, the problem is that either they would have to have very rich parents who could pay for that, or afterwards they'd have to have a job where they could make a lot of money to pay the debts afterwards. I mean, those are the two possibilities.
Right. So one of the things that I'm curious about is, do your are your kids happy as doctors? Are they enjoying their career?
Yeah, they're doing very different things. My daughter wants to become a general practitioner, so she's on her education for that. Medical school is 6 years, and then after that, you have to go to different apartments in the hospitals for a year, and then after that, it's a 5-year education to be a general practitioner, and she's in the middle of that right now. She
Wow,
has
5 years. So that's like in the field. It's sort of like she's basically continuing education in the field, actually practicing in the area of interest that she has.
Yeah, exactly. She's going to different parts of the hospital. She has to know something about surgery, something about older people, something about what is it called in English? Well, all those different specialties, and she's very interested in that. And she has a little kid, and she has another on the way, so she has a lot of things to look after.
Wow,
But
that's a lot of balls to juggle.
then my son, he's going quite another way, because he was become he became interested in research, and made what do you call that?
Studies.
Yeah, studies. He studied. He's working in a medical company called Novo right now, who's doing medications for diabetics and stuff like that.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. So he
So.
okay. So that's I'm really happy to hear that your kids were able to pursue their interests in school and have a career that they're interested in, and that's great.
Yeah, I think so too.
That's the whole point, is that we need to explore the world until we find the niche or the area of interest that we're truly passionate about, and then go for it, whether it's comic books and storytelling, or whether it's, saving people's lives or managing their health.
My father, of course, and my mother thought it was very risky and very strange that I gave up the medical school in order to be a cartoonist. But they got used to it, and I'm very happy making my living doing this. On the other hand, a lot of my of the youngsters of my friends, they said, okay, now you could pursue what you really wanted and give up this job that you just this education that you just made just to make a living. And that's not true either, because I thought it was very interesting. But I mean, you only have one life, and I became a parent also, and I could just see that I couldn't be a full-time doctor. It's a full-time job, and at the same time be a cartoonist, which is also a full-time job. And the persons who would suffer would be my children. So I had to choose, and then I chose because I could see I could make a living working with my stories. So that was what I did.
Well, and I would imagine that, I mean, I'm just guessing here, but the work of a cartoonist is something that was something you could do at home rather than having to leave and go away to an office 8 or 10 hours a day or something. Did it give you more flexibility or access in a way as a parent to your children?
Yeah, and it was also my passion, what I really found out that what was most interesting to me. But I just want to stress that it was not that I thought having a proper education and all that was just to have something to fall back on if the other thing failed. I mean, I really started studying medicine because I thought it was interesting. I still think it's terribly interesting. And this sounds like I'm probably a very spoiled child, because I had the choice between two very interesting careers,
I don't know, we could call that spoiled, or we could call it an ideal that would be worth working towards so that everyone in the world has multiple opportunities in front of them.
Yeah, I prefer that.
Yep. All right. Well, basically, we're out of time. So I want to thank you so much for joining me and sharing all these really interesting insights and backgrounds into your stories and whatnot.
It's been a pleasure being part of the show.
All right, folks. So that is our show today. I hope that, like me, Focus On and Prose, Poetry, and Purpose allow you to contemplate new ideas and ask more creative questions about what is possible. Many thanks go to Windermere Vachon once again, because it is specifically their generosity that has given me the opportunity to create this show. My name is March Twisdale. You've been listening to my interview with Peter Madsen here on Focus On. And now I'll leave you with a snippet of a song from an Icelandic band I've fallen in love with called Of Monsters and Men.